Who knows who the fastest man in the world is? I'm talking about a real man, not Superman, but the fastest man in the world. Mr. Demers, I don't know if I can trust you when you raise your hand. Yeah, thank you. Usain Bolt. He is the fastest man in the world. And with Mr. Demers' Jamaican heritage, every Jamaican knows who this Jamaican is. Usain Bolt is the fastest person ever. He is regarded and known as the fastest human being ever. He's the first man in history to hold both the 100 meters and 200 meters world records since fully automatic time measurements began or started in the late 70s. So, you know, nowadays they don't have people. If you ran track back in my day, they had officials standing at the finish line with stopwatches, and when you crossed, they would hit the stopwatch and they would do your time. Well, late 70s, they came up with the automatic timing so that when you go across, they're able to capture it by picture, and they're able to get it down to, used to be the tenth of a second, then the hundredth of a second, then a thousandth of a second. So he's got the world records in both 100 meters and 200 meters, and he, with his teammates, has the world record in the 4x100 meters relay. He's the reigning Olympic champion in all three of these events. He's the first man to win 6 Olympic gold medals in sprinting, and he is an 8-time world champion. He was the first to achieve a double-double, winning both the 100 meters and the 200 meters at consecutive Olympics. So in 2008, he won both of those events, and in 2012, he won both of those events. And then he topped this by getting the first triple-triple, as they call it, because he also won gold in both Olympics for the 4x100 meters. At the 2013 World Championships in Moscow, Lightning Bolt, which is his name, he completed another hat trick of 200-meter world titles by winning his third straight gold. In 2009, he broke more than one record in one race. He broke his own world record for the 100 meters. Now, when I used to run, I don't even walk fast nowadays unless I have to. But when I used to run, we went by yards. So when I ran track, it was the 100 yards. It wasn't the 100 meters. And if anyone got near 10 seconds, 100 meters is longer, by the way. That's why I'm making the point. Anyone got near 10 seconds in 100 yards, that was very impressive. But he did, his record was 9.69 seconds for 100 meters. And then he broke it, and the world record is 9.58. So he set the world record, and he also set a record for how much he broke the record by. We're talking tenths of a second, I realize that, but it's the most that the world record had ever been broken. And if you were to watch a YouTube video or something, the guy who came in second, when he set that record at 9.58, the guy's name was Tyson Gay, and he ran it in 9.71, which was a U.S. record at the time. But he finished, when you're talking about tenths of a second in a 100 meters race, it looked like he was way behind Lightning Bolt, as he is known. Well, he's also famous because of another situation that he was involved in. The world's fastest man shocked everybody by bolting out of the starting blocks early. So he was disqualified from the 100-meter final under a controversial false start rule. Now, they call it controversial because they changed it. So if any of you have ever, if you've ran track or if you watch track and field and things of that nature, it used to be that if you started from the blocks early, you got another chance. So they'd line everybody up, including that person, and they'd get another chance. If you did it twice, the world record holder in the Olympics prior to that, or it might have been the Olympics in Barcelona, I don't remember, it was at 96 or somewhere in there, but the world record holder then, he did come out twice and was completely disqualified. If you can jog your memory, he stayed on the track for a long time because he was not happy about being disqualified. But he did that. He came off the blocks early twice and they disqualified him. Well, they changed the rule to where if you did it once, you were disqualified. And then Lightning Bolt was the first one to do that. So he instead of getting the warning, he was disqualified and he wasn't able to run the race. Now, that's called a false start. False starts are in a lot of different sports. Some of you might be fans of Michael Phelps since he's from the Baltimore area. Well, you remember he won the 8 Olympic gold medals, and he was on pace to win 8 medals in the world championships, and he won 7 gold medals, and then somebody in his 4x4 relay started early. They started a false start, and that disqualified the whole team. So he only won 7 medals instead of 8 at that point in time. So a false start is a movement by a participant before they are supposed to go. The opposite of this, the opposite of a false start in any kind of a sport is called a clean start. There's other terms for it, but that's the official name. So if everybody lines up and they all go at the right time when they are allowed to go, then it's called a clean start. That's what it's called. And the title for the sermon this afternoon is A Clean Start. I have encouraged you, and I think in all 3 congregations, to keep the holy days as we lead up to them, as we study for them, as we prepare for them, whether it's spring or the fall, to always keep the holy days in perspective to God's plan of salvation for humanity. And that's what each of us should do. We should keep the holy days in perspective of God's plan of salvation for humanity. And with that in mind, let's turn to Exodus chapter 12. We're going to look through some of the scriptures quickly for the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread. In the morning, Mr. Horchak read Leviticus 23. I'm going to read from Exodus 12. So we recognize that the Passover is instituted, the first 4 verses here in this chapter. Let's just read through this. Exodus 12, 1 through 4, where it says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, 'This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of persons, according to each man's needs. You shall make your count for the lamb.'" And we know that this lamb was to be without blemish, this sacrifice without blemish, a male of the first year. And it had to be from the sheep's, from the sheep or from the goats. Then they keep it until they were to sacrifice it, and they were to take some of the blood and put it on the 2 doorposts, as it says in verse 7. When we went home Saturday night, later I turned on the TV, and the Ten Commandments was on. So I enjoy watching it. It's a long movie. I didn't intend to stay up and watch all of it, but the part that we did catch while the TV was on was where they're painting the blood on the doorpost. And God comes through, of course, and kills the firstborn. We understand that the death of the firstborn was the 10th plague. And so we see that the Passover is instituted in these verses. And then Exodus 12 again, starting in verse 15. We read that 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leavened bread from that first day into the 7th, that person shall be cut off from Israel. So, how many of you ate unleavened bread this week? Don't raise your hand. Did I say unleavened bread? I meant leavened bread. Just trying to be funny. I don't have any jokes written in my notes, so I'm trying to think of something here. So how many of us ate unleavened bread? Sure, we'd raise our hand. I hope so. I try to do it every day. How many of us ate leavened bread? Don't raise your hand. That's the point I was making. Obviously, we have to be aware of these things, and we're told to eat unleavened bread. We're told not to eat the leavened bread. Verse 16, on the first day there shall be a holy convocation. On the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. That's where we are today. No matter of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared by you. So we see that we can prepare food on the holy days. Verse 17, so you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For on the same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened. In all your habitations you shall eat unleavened bread. So we recognize that this was instituted for the people of Israel. When we read through Leviticus 23, we recognize that these are God's feasts that God instituted, and that He commands His people to observe, to be aware of, to make sure that we strive to do as we are commanded during these days, during this time period, and that we eat nothing leavened in all our habitations, but we shall eat unleavened bread. So we recognize the importance that God places on this for His people. Let's turn to Exodus 13. Again, where we have the days of unleavened bread mentioned, Exodus 13, verse 3. And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, for out of the house of bondage. For by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place, and no leavened bread shall be eaten. So we see some of what we are to remember, some of what we are to reflect on, some of what we are to understand. And so when it says you've been brought out of the house of bondage, literally out of slavery, and we have covered the symbolism of this time period from the Old Testament or Old Covenant to the New Covenant, understanding that we are brought out of the bondage or slavery of sin, and Egypt symbolizing sin. So on this day, verse 4, you're going out in the day of Abib. And it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites, the Jebusites, which He swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. And no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. Notice verse 8. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be as a sign to you on your hand, and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. So we recognize that it's appropriate each year that we talk and reflect about our calling and the fact that God has extended to us His great mercy and His wonderful kindness. I mean, that's part of what we reflect on during these days of unleavened bread. We recognize God's love and kindness. We emphasize God's love towards us, toward His children, towards His people. And it is appropriate, as is mentioned in these verses, that we emphasize this with our children, that we talk to them. Parents in God's church have a huge responsibility. So this is just a side point. As we are able, as parents, we are commanded to teach our children. Sometimes as grandparents, we have the opportunity more through example, but as we can, we strive to teach our children. Verse 8, it makes it so clear, tell your son. That means tell your kids in that day, saying, this is done. Why are we doing this? There's a night to be much observed. Of course, we have another year before we go through it again. And I hope everyone had a wonderful night to be much observed. We did, as I mentioned, we very much enjoyed it and appreciated it. And I thought it was very uplifting and encouraging. And it's a good time to talk about our calling and coming out of the world and various things that God has done for us. And when it says it shall be as a sign in verse 9 on your hand and as a memorial, it's talking about when we do things like we're doing today. When we're obeying God and we're coming together during a holy convocation, and our children see what we're doing and they need to understand what we're doing. It's our responsibility to teach them. I'm going to turn to Deuteronomy 6 for just a moment. Just to emphasize the importance that we have as families to teach our children. It is very interesting as life goes on, looking at the small children that we have here today, the babies and the young people that we have. It's always fascinating to me to think back to our children. I'm not going to tell any stories on them, but just to mention that when they were young and having the influence as parents and teaching them about God's way of life and teaching them about the Bible, I guess I will tell one story. Now that I think of it, with Vivian, for a long time, since she's visiting, she fussed and fussed and fussed for a dog. And we had a dog, and I didn't want a second dog, but she was a little girl. Little girls are sweet. And she kept asking for a dog and asking for a dog, and she would cry for a dog, and she would tell us how she would train her dog and all this kind of stuff. And Valerie overheard her praying for a dog, and Valerie said, you have to get her a dog. And eventually, I broke down. They remind me, every time I complain about having two dogs, well, you said yes. So we have two dogs. One's Vivi's dog. And later, this is sometime after we had the dog and talking to the girls, teaching them about praying, I asked Vivi specifically, how do you know God answers prayers? And she says, well, I have a dog, don't I? But it is interesting as far as the influence on our young people, how quickly, as parents and grandparents, as families, we can lose control. We lose control of the sphere of influence of our children. Because if we're not teaching them, society is, somehow or another. Whether it's TV, whether it's songs, whether it's movies, whether it's the peer pressure from school, whatever it is. Somehow our children are being taught. And as they get older, parents, I know some of you have been through this before, where we are in the transition that we are. Now we have adults. That's just incredible to think about. And when they have jobs, that'll be even better. But they're adults, and they grow up quickly is the point that I'm making. And before you know it, they're making their own decisions. And so it's important that we are teaching them as God has commanded us to. And when you look here in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, it says, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Now, when we talk about loving God, Mr. Jackson emphasizes this. I do. You hear other men who speak where it's emphasized. If we love God, then we are striving to do what God commands us to do. We love Him because He first loved us. And I've asked you before, and you're able to do this, how do you finish this verse? If you love me, keep my commandments. We know this. So we're looking at obedience. If we love God, we're striving to live His way. So that's the emphasis that's being made here. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. And how do we know this? It's not just saying it, as we heard earlier. It's living it. So we love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our might. And these words I command you today shall be in your heart. So in a few minutes here, we'll read about the crossing through the Red Sea. And we know that when they went from the Red Sea, they went to Mount Sinai. And we know that the law was written on stone. And they had hearts of stone. They were hardened. We call them stiff-necked Israelites. Because they were hardened in their hearts and not obeying God. We talked about it. Just one example of the 12 spies, where 10 of them just wouldn't do what God said to do. They saw things with their eyes, they heard things with their ears, and as physical human beings, they couldn't obey God. They were hardened in their heart against what God was telling them to do. And of course now, we know that through God's Holy Spirit, we can have God's laws in our hearts, and it's demonstrated by how we live. So these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. One of the things I pray for the most diligently, just to share a personal note, in praying for God's kingdom, for Christ to return, for the millennium to be established, it's not to be a king and priest, although that's exciting. But it's about the fact that every human being will have, everyone alive will have opportunity to know God and to have God's Spirit in them and to have God's way of life in their heart. So that's how they want to live. It's according to God's way of life. And if they don't, we'll whack them. Kindly, of course. Out of love, as we'll be motivated by. But I long for that time. And so these words, verse 6, which I command you today, shall be in your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children. So notice how it talks about teaching diligently to our children. Because it says that you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. And you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. Now, there's some truth that they wanted God's law around them and to be visible. But what it's emphasizing is that they were living it. Because how many of us, when we are teaching our children, how many of us were waiting by their bed, waiting for them to wake up with our Bible opened? And, okay, you're awake now. We're going to start right here. I don't care if you're hungry. You're going to listen to me before you have breakfast. And walking it through Walmart's and... Maybe nowadays you can get your iPad out and start going through the scriptures. Well, we should understand that when it's talking about this, it's saying as parents, as grandparents, uncles, aunts, whatever it might be, we have a responsibility to teach our young people, to teach our children by how we live. When you go through all these things about sitting down, standing up, walking, when you lie down, we use everyday situations in life to teach our children and our young people about God's way of life, how to make choices based upon God's way of life. So if we love them, we will do them. And part of that is the fact that we keep or observe the times that God says to observe as holy times. The days of unleavened bread. And we talk about why we observe the days of unleavened bread. Hopefully those of you with children have your children help you clean for the days of unleavened bread. And hopefully you have your children help you cook unleavened bread or bake unleavened bread. I will be honest, I don't help bake unleavened bread. But I like it when our children do. Mrs. Horchak was telling us about how she was working with her grandson, I think it was, and how they were hurrying to do the unleavened bread, just like the Israelites, how they had to hurry and cook and flour going everywhere, and they were baking bread in that way to make those points. Well, we should be doing that when we sit down, when we stand up at the bedside. So how we live, what we do, why we do, what it represents, what it means. And we talk about our calling. And it doesn't matter if you're second or third generation. I know a lot of our young people don't have that calling directly out of the world. They do. They have the calling. But I mean, if you never knew the truth or saw it. My grandmother was converted in the 50s and baptized. My mother in the early 60s. So I would be third generation. Our children would be fourth generation. They have that calling. But some of you don't have family in God's church. And you can emphasize the wonderful blessing of God calling you out of the bondage of slavery and talk about the symbolism and teach our children why we are doing what we're doing. Back to Exodus chapter 14 this time. Mr. Ebersol in the sermonette read the verse where God told the children of Israel to go forward. Verse 16, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. Now, so we understand this was a miracle. We don't try to minimize it. We don't try to say that it's just a story. We believe that God parted the sea. And this is the part, if I could only see one part of the Ten Commandments movie, this would be the part that I like to see each time, is when the sea opens up and there's the walls of water and the Israelites go through on the dry ground, and how grateful they are to God for this deliverance, for what He's doing for them. Verse 22, so the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And we know that the Egyptians pursued, went after them into the midst of the sea. Pharaoh, the horses, his chariots, and we know that they were drowned. So we see this crossing of the Red Sea. And we understand that the children of Israel at that time, they were given salvation. They were saved in that sense from Pharaoh, from the Egyptian army that was chasing them. We recognize that that crossing of the Red Sea was a type of baptism. That it was a clean start. They had a clean start to know God and to obey God. To know the truth and to live the truth. So they had a clean start. Mr. Ebersol referred to 1 Corinthians 10. I'd like to turn there. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. verse 1 in 1 Corinthians 10, where it's talking about the examples, as Mr. Ebersole spoke of. It says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." So it is a type of baptism. And in that sense, it is a clean start. It was a clean start for them. We have a clean start, of course, with the salvation that God offers us. And every year, we have a reminder. We talked about the fact that every year we should recognize that we need to be committed. And if we have fallen short, we need to recommit to the vows that we make at baptism and to the commitments that we make to God. And so we're able to have a clean start. Last Sabbath, and I think it was last Sabbath, I was talking to some people about great-grandparents and grandparents not having running water, electricity. When I went to my grandparents' farm in Tennessee, we used to go down there in the summers and help work on the farm as much as boys could and try to stay out of trouble as much as young boys could. But my grandparents, they didn't have running water and didn't have electricity. So we of course were used to outhouses and things of that nature. Well, one hot summer day, we go to the creek. I loved this creek. It was a wonderful creek to swim in and to play in for young boys. And it was called Sugar Creek, which I just thought was a wonderful name. And I know there's Sugar Creeks all over the country. But this one close to my grandparents' house, that was the name of it, Sugar Creek. And we'd have to cross a barbed wire fence and run through the field because there was a bull that didn't like people crossing the field. And it didn't bother us much at the creek. And so we knew that, so we could play at the creek. And then when we were done, we'd have to run back across and get back over the fence. And eventually we got smarter and took a BB gun. But at first we didn't. One time while we were there, as little boys would do, we picked up some, I'm trying to think of the appropriate term, cow patties, cow pies. just the right mixture of a little hardness and a little moisture, so we could fling them and hit the other person, and so they were solid enough that we could throw them and moist enough that they would stick. So we did that for a little while, and then one of us, I don't know who it was, took off running and slid. So we chased all these cows out from under a tree by the creek and slid in these cow patties and jumped in the creek and washed off and got back out. And after a few times of this, with a lot of water mixing in here, we were really sliding. And so we got to where we could run and grab a low branch on the tree and swing out and let go and right down the bank. Jump in the water, wash off, get out, and do it again. Well, to us, it's all fun. But when we got to my grandparents' house, apparently the smell got there before we did. Because we had to take our clothes off on the back porch, and we had to sit out there until they could fill the tub. That's what we took our bath in, was a big metal tub. I don't know what you call them other than that. And once they got the water filled and we could take our bath, we could go on with the day. Telling you that story because we had a clean start. And that's what I'm emphasizing, is that with the time that we are in, during God's plan of salvation for humanity, this is, for us, a clean start. And certainly when God calls us, when we go through our personal repentance and baptism and receiving God's Spirit, and every year we are reminded about what God has done for us, where we are in the plan of salvation, that we have been given a clean start. Now, if you read down through here, after verse 2, where all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. So again, these were people that God wanted to bless, wanted to give the promised land, and they rejected what God did. As physical human beings, they looked on the physical. They weren't focused on what God had already done for them and what God would do for them. So He wasn't pleased with them. And we know the Bible tells us if we do well, if we live by faith, God will be pleased. And that is so important that we recognize that. Hold your place here and turn to Hebrews chapter 11. We're coming right back to 1 Corinthians 10, but Hebrews chapter 11. I'm not the only one, I'm sure, that does this, but I try to emphasize this verse in baptism counseling. Verse 6. But without faith, it is impossible to please Him, meaning God. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. So without faith, it's impossible to please God. And we have gone over and over and over. Now, whenever that time comes, we're not in any hurry, but the church asks us to go somewhere else. I hope that you remember. Do you remember how many times that Mr. Waddle said, what did James mean when he said, I will show you my faith? What did he pull out of his pocket other than Lent? Nothing. He did it by how he lived. He showed his faith by his obedience to God. So when it says it's impossible without faith to please God, it's talking about doing what God has taught us, is teaching us, has given us. So verse 5, back in 1 Corinthians 10, it says, but with most of them, God was not well pleased because they weren't doing or didn't do what He asked them to do. Their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. So after 40 years of wandering, it was only the millennials who went into the promised land. The rest of them, baby boomers, Generation Xers. Now, I was happy with that survey myself, because I'm right on the edge of the baby boomers, and it's the first time I've ever heard the years that where I was born put into Generation X. So I prefer that as opposed to baby boomers. Nothing personal, but you know. So, only the young people went into the promised land. Verse 6, now these things became our examples through the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So we know, it says, most of them, God was not well pleased. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Faith is a demonstration of our belief in God and that we obey Him, that we want to obey Him. Verse 7, and do not become idolaters as some of them, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell. So the point that Paul's making through these examples is that God was working with them, and they were not doing things or living in a way that was pleasing to God. And that's what it says, that with most of them, God was not well pleased. And without faith, it's impossible to please God. Verse 9, nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor murmur, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. So we know it's easy to complain. There's the verse that tells us, do all things without disputing, without complaining. So we have to strive to do that. But some of them were murmurers. They murmured. They were destroyed by the destroyer. Verse 11, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, so because of all these examples that we have of people who didn't please God, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Now we know verse 13. It's probably a memory verse for most of us, even if we can't say it's 1 Corinthians 10:13. But we read it, and we recognize it, and we find comfort in the fact that God won't test us or won't put us in situations that without giving us a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. And I know sometimes it doesn't feel that way, but brethren, we believe the Scriptures. So, verse 15, he says, I speak as to wise men. Judge for yourselves what I say. Judge for yourselves what I say. So I speak as to wise men. That's what he's saying. And so I understand. Today I'm speaking to wise men and women who understand that God has called us out of the world to be an example, to be a light to the world, to demonstrate that His way of life works. We understand that God has given us a clean start as human beings. Now, every single day, you and I have the opportunity for a clean start. No matter what we did yesterday, if we're willing to repent before God, if we're willing to draw near to God, God will always draw near to us. We have the opportunity every day for a clean start. Mr. Horchak read through Isaiah, and verse 16 of chapter 1 that he read, it talked about wash yourself, clean yourself before God. So we know that we do that. By humbling ourselves before God, by staying in that repentant attitude. So in the sermon this past Sabbath, Mr. Jackson emphasized Matthew 5:48 about going on to perfection. My wife might remember that some time ago, this goes back long enough that we had children, but I doubt they could remember this, but I think my wife might remember this. I gave a whole message about Matthew 5:48, and the fact that God expects us to strive for His standards. And He says, be you perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. And if we read through Hebrews chapter 6, the foundational principles or fundamental doctrines of the church, it says, once we have the foundation laid, what are we to do? Just going to pause so you can think about it. We are to go on to perfection. And so I gave the whole message on it, and an elder, I don't think any of you know him, and you won't meet him at a Kogwa service, but he came up afterwards and said, there is no way God expects us to be perfect or to strive for perfection. So no matter how you want to put it, God has standards, and God expects us to strive to be godly, to live up to His standards. We're striving to be as God is God. And so it is our responsibility to go on to perfection. I've given a whole message before about the Six Sigma. Is anybody Six Sigma certified here? By chance? It tends to be for engineers and people of that nature. When I was with General Electric, they did an experiment on the sales force because they wanted all their engineers to be Six Sigma certified. And the meaning of this is like IOS 9000 or 9001 or 2 or whatever it is now. It's just a quality assurance process. And so they had all the engineers go through this big testing, and it's all about statistics and algorithms, and you put them in the computer, and then you get the outliers, and you can figure out why this error is happening or that error, that kind of thing. And when I went through college, I had one math class, and I only did it because this lovely lady I was dating, I wasn't even married to her, so I, you know how it is when your brain's not working right. But she said, you really should take this math class, this college algebra class. And I did as a senior. I didn't need it, and I made a D. But anyway, that's the only math class I took because I didn't need math otherwise for my liberal arts degree. And but they did an experiment with the sales force because they wanted us to become Six Sigma certified. So they mixed us in with the engineers and sent us to the same 6 weeks of classes on statistics and mathematical processes and all this kind of stuff and wanted us to do this. And the reason I'm bringing this out, as I was talking about in Hebrews 6, that we are to go on to perfection, this idea behind Six Sigma, it means that out of a million processes, whatever a process is, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's on the phone, customer service, whatever the opportunities are, out of a million processes, 99.99966% of the time, you're correct, or you do it right without an error. Even at that, so that's 99.99966% of the time. That was the standard that they were hoping that that we would get to. Well, if you're just 99% good, here's one of the statistics they give us in the little propaganda book they gave us. So 99% good. If you're 99% good, there's at least 20,000 pieces of lost mail per hour. So in the postal system, there's at least 20,000 pieces of lost mail per hour. Every one of us, if we have city drinking water, we would experience unsafe drinking water 15 minutes out of every day. Now, there's some parts of the world that would think, that's great. I can live with that. But that's not what we would expect in America. There would be two short or long landings at every airport each day. So it seems like we're always reading about an accident or emergency landing or something of this nature, but I have flown a lot and I've never had that. I don't know if Mr. Jackson has experienced it, but if 99% itself is good enough, there would be two long or short, somehow they'd miss the runway, one way or the other, at every airport, the major airports, every day. And then we would experience a loss of electricity for at least 7 hours each month. So that's just some practical situations where we can see that if we just say mediocre is good enough, and I know my wife would probably tell you if I was a good husband 99% of the time, she could settle for that. But we don't want to say that as a Christian I'm good enough. We want that clean start, and we want to each and every day of our life strive to please God. I mean, we want to strive to please God. So without faith, it's impossible to please God. I will show you my faith by how I live, based upon what I know. Ephesians chapter 5. Now here in Ephesians, I was trying to figure out what verses to read or not read. We could probably read the whole chapter. Just starting off at verse 1, it says, "Therefore be followers of God." And I want to turn to these verses, read these verses. Here's some dynamics of Christians striving to make the most of a clean start. "Therefore be followers of God as dear children." And the idea behind that is, if you see parents with young children or grandparents with young children, like Mr. Horchak talking about his 5-year-old grandson, and there's a while where your children think you know everything. And they think you are wonderful and you can do no wrong. And whatever you tell them must be right, unless you tell them to sit in the front seat. But they understand that the parents love them and care for them. That's the way God intends it to be. And so be followers of God as dear children, recognizing that our Father has our best interest in mind and loves us and care for us. And walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given Himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling or smelling aroma. And then it goes through a list of things that it's just not fitting for those of us who have had a clean start. It even tells us in verse 5 not to be an unclean person. Don't live this way. If we know better, if we've had a clean start, then as Mr. Ebersol said, go forward. Go forward, living as if we have an inheritance in the kingdom of God, of Christ and God. Verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. So don't be a partaker. Verse 8, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of the light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, proving what is acceptable to the Lord. If it's acceptable to the Lord, it's pleasing. It's pleasing to God. And then we go through another section of things, of ways not to be. And it says, don't even try to know everything that's going on in society. I have a proclivity of any news article that tends to talk about social trends or issues, I like to read it. I like to see where humanity is or what society's thinking. But there are times where I'm reading through, whether it's lifestyles or whatever it might be, and I think, why am I putting this in my mind? Society might be doing this. It might be acceptable to some people, but I don't want to know. And that's what we're told here, for it is shameful, verse 12, even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. Verse 14, therefore he says, awake you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. So he's talking about us. He tells us in verse 16, redeem the time, because the days are evil. So those who have a clean start, they're going to redeem the time. They're going to make the most of the time that we have. Coming down to verse 20, giving thanks always. This is part of what we do when we have a clean start. We recognize how much gratitude we owe our God, our Father. Giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Submitting to one another in the fear of God. Now that goes against human nature, goes against society. Having that ability to be under authority, we should all understand. Again, I speak as to wise men, people who are educated in spiritual things, who understand. God won't have anyone in His kingdom who is not able to submit to authority. That includes every single one of us. God will not have someone in His kingdom who cannot submit to authority. Submit to one another in the fear of God. And then we see the instructions for marriage. That God created marriage to be a blessing. He wants it to be a blessing. And He gives us guidelines. He gives us teachings. Verse 25, husbands, Mr. Diggins, love your wife. It's true for all of us. Husbands, love your wife. Jonathan, did you get that scripture? All right, make sure you write that down. Study that verse. Husbands, love your wives. And we have the perfect example. Just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for it, that He might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the Word. So we see, again, we have a clean start, that He might present it to Himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle. So it doesn't say, you know, if you like those wrinkles, it's okay. It doesn't say that. It says without spot, without wrinkle. So that we're striving for God's standards. Christ gave Himself for it, that He might present it to Himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Without blemish. So we have that opportunity, that chance to go forward with a clean start. In Psalm 19, mentioned before, this is one of my favorite psalms. If I sit down with the Bible and I haven't been studying something and I just, I don't know if you ever do this, just let the Bible drop open. I don't do it either. But if I'm not studying something, I will turn to certain psalms or proverbs and read through them. And Psalm 19 is one that I turn to over and over again. This time I want to start in the first half of it where it says in verse 1, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament show His handiwork." And so again, brethren, we should certainly see God in creation. So the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. "Day unto day utter speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them He has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race." So I mentioned earlier about these world-class sprinters who would get a false start, and they would... There was one who laid down on the track. I don't remember his name. I don't know if you remember it from the Olympics, but he was false started. He was disqualified, and he would not get off the track. He actually laid down on the track and delayed the race for an hour because he was so upset about being disqualified and not being able to run. So a strong person who has trained, who has prepared, they're eager for the race. They want to be a part of that race. That's what it's talking about here. That when the sun comes out, it rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Who can stop the sun from going through its circuit, where it rises in the east in the morning and sets in the west? If you could run through a football field, team of tacklers that way, you would rejoice every time they gave you the ball. You look like Forrest Gump. Run, Forrest, run. You remember that? He ran through when he played for Alabama, and he ran from one end of the field to the other end. So the idea behind this of rejoicing like a strong man, somebody that has prepared themselves for the race. Now, that's what it's talking about. So I speak today to strong men and women and to young people. I speak today to wise people in the spiritual sense who have understanding of what God expects of us. And I speak today to people who have a clean start. So, brethren, now is the time to be the Christians God wants us to be. Now is the time to be the Christian you want to be. When we wake up tomorrow, don't wait for next week. Now is the time for us. We have a clean start. So run the race as strong Christians.